Blog Talk Radio.
Blessings from the Darkness is an eclectic collection of writings by a talented and diverse group of writers and published authors in dedication of and in support of our dearest friend, the award-winning and best-selling author Yvonne Mason and her son. All sales of this anthology, present and future, are donated to her in support of her son, who at the time of this publication has been ill and out of work and struggling to support his family due to an undiagnosed illness. Yvonne has been an inspiration, selflessly supportive, and a dear friend to many aspiring writers and indie authors. She believes in paying it forward, offering her knowledge and insights and friendship to kindred souls. Yvonne has a saying, she threatens to let loose the flying monkeys when there is wrongness in the lives of those near and dear to her. So after bringing us together for a successful and fun-filled double anthology by Yvonne, including notable authors and first-time published writers, and after learning about the continued troubles of her son and his family, we came together as such monkeys to fly free, far, and wide in what we do best, G.L. Lentz. This book can be purchased at Amazon.com, Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble, and www.blackbedsheetbooks.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason, and yes, guilty. That was another shameless plug for Blessings from the Darkness. For those of you who don't know, my son is ill. They don't know what's wrong with him, can't find out what's wrong with him. And some indie author friends of mine, unbeknownst to me, as well as the one and only Nicholas Grabowski, who I absolutely adore, and my friend and publisher Kelly J. Koch with Dressing Your Book, put this book together. And every penny of this book goes to my son. None of the writers get a dime of it. Nicholas doesn't get a dime of it. Kelly doesn't get a dime of it. And I don't get a dime of it. Every penny goes to my son. So if you're so inclined and would like to help my son support his family, we would all be most appreciated. So that is the end of my shameless advertising. Tonight I have, oh, and before I tell you about the wonderful author I have, as of this morning, this show, between the podcast and the live shows, has 5,326 listeners. So why in the world are you not on my show? I ask you, why in the world would you not want to be on this show? Whether you have a platform, a book, a piece of music, a piece of artwork, a business, whatever, you just want to call and talk, why would you not want to do it on my show? So now let's move on to the fun part. My guest tonight is an absolute master at what he does. And I do mean a master. The man kept me up all night reading his book. I wanted to throttle him. But it's an excellent, excellent book. My guest is Paul Hurd, who writes under the name Thomas S. Mulvey, M-U-L-V-A-U-G-H. Well, we'll get into the reason why he writes under that pen name, but the name just rolls off of one's tongue. You cannot forget it. He has spent most of his childhood growing up on a dairy farm a few miles north of Cassville, Missouri. When the chores were done and playtime came, because his siblings were much older than him, he found that his imagination was his greatest ally. This allowed him to create cities and characters in his mind. Then the first story that he wrote was about one of the cats on the farm, and he made the cat into a human being. Then when he got a typewriter for Christmas, yes, ladies and gentlemen, a typewriter, not a computer, a typewriter, he wrote more stories. Then that was just the beginning of his lifelong career as a writer. Paul graduated from Cassville R4 High School, and then he attended Crowder College and majored in business and automotive technology. When he left college, he went back to his first love of writing. He wrote several articles in various automotive magazines. That led to his first book, Chevelle SS Restoration Guide, published by Motor Books International. And then 9 other titles would follow with this publisher before he would venture into the publishing field himself and start his own company, which is called PAH Publishing. With his own company, he would author under many different pen names more than 20 other titles. In 2015, the call back to creating stories called him, and under the pen name of Thomas S. Mulvey, he would author and publish his first novel, Blood Necklace, a murder mystery set in his hometown of Cassville, Missouri, that centers on former Kansas City homicide detective Rick Ryder, whose high school sweetheart is murdered at Roaring River State Park, and he returns to Cassville to solve it, but what he finds is a twisting tale of lies that will change his life forever. Now, still writing under the name Thomas S. Mulvey, Hurd is completing his second novel, Blood Curse, which is part of the Blood series with Detective Ryder. And we're not going to talk about that one yet. We're not going to talk about either one of them yet. Today, Hurd makes his home in Monet, Missouri with his wife, Carly, where he continues to operate PAH Publishing and writes and has more books planned. He also currently does book signings with his friend from Crowder College, an author that I had on here a couple of nights ago, who writes romance, Leanne Santamayor Murphy. Now, this is going to be a fun-filled and exciting hour, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, Paul. How are you, my friend? Thank you for the pleasure and the honor and the privilege of coming on my show.
Well, thank you for having me. Yes. I'm really stoked to be here. So.
Well, let's just get right to it, because my word, you got enough history behind you to last most people 10 lifetimes. Let's talk about your history a little bit. How did you get involved in From the Dairy Farm and your imagination? Because that apparently that's where it all started. Tell me how that. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, tell me how that all came about.
Basically, like I said, I kind of grew up as an only child because my I had five brothers and sisters, but they was all older. They was all gone, and my youngest, oldest sister was 10 years older than I was, and she was, by the time I was 7, she was off to college. And so I was basically, to entertain myself, I had to invent things. We weren't the richest place, richest people to all the toys and stuff. So I would invent things and ideas, and to the cats and the cows and dogs, that I kind of make them into like real people and do it that way. So it was just... that's kind of where it all started, I think.
Well, for people that don't, let's say city folk,
yeah,
that don't understand what growing up in the day on a dairy farm meant, give them a little bit of the background of what living, I mean, you're out in the middle of nowhere mostly.
Yeah, basically we were 7 miles outside of the town, that Cassville, and the nearest neighbor down the road was about a half a mile away, so... And there was no kids anywhere at around that area. There was always older farmers, and so I was basically the only kid around that way too. So, but basically, day starts real early, probably about 5 o'clock in the morning, for the cows to be milked, and you get that done, and I'd have about time enough to get on to change and get aboard the school bus then at 6:30.
And then what time would you get home in the afternoon?
Well, we get out of school at 3, and I'd ride the bus for about 90 minutes. So it would be about 40, it'd be about 4:30 when I got home. And then the whole thing starts again with the evening milking. And you'd
and
be
how
done.
Long how long did it take y'all to milk the cows?
Probably about that, about 6 to about 6 o'clock.
And then it was time to eat dinner.
Yeah, that's basically it, yeah.
And then probably in about an hour or two after the sun went down, you went to bed because you had to get up so early.
Yeah, usually it was 8 to 9 o'clock by the time I was in bed then.
Well, what I find interesting is your imagination became your playmates. The animals on the farm basically became your playmates in your mind, in your stories.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So tell me about the story about the cat that you made into a human.
Well,
and
that
how
was
old were you when you did that?
I think I was probably about 10 years old, I think. Because I'd write stories down, like I'd write like maybe a news story or something like that I'd make up, and I'd do it on, paper. And, of course, my sister, which is the one I was telling you about, Ruth, she bought me a typewriter one time for Christmas, one of these little portable Smith & Coronas. And I started typing on that with basically the one finger. And I started typing about this story about the cat and the dog, that they were people and they went on this trip into Oklahoma and to get something. I don't even remember now what it was, to get something, and they come back and do this. And it was just a silly little story, but, that's how it starts that way. So.
Well, did you read your stories to your family and entertain them?
Oh, yeah. I read that to Dad, and he just laughed. I mean, that just tickled him to death that I had that imagination. So
You were not a bored child, were you?
No, not really, no. There was always something going on. I was, when my cousins would come up, they'd come to visit, I would always be the one who would come up with the idea, okay, we'll play this, and this thing over here is a filling station, the barn is a big mansion or something, and it was my imagination that would drive them to play along with whatever I could dream up, so.
You are a born writer, my friend, a born writer.
I want to look back at it, I kind of do that way, but, the only time I ever got to the point that I actually thought maybe I had some skill as a writer was in high school. I happened to have a creative writing instructor or teacher that most kids didn't like her. She was very hard-lined, kind of rude, I mean, just almost rude to the students. And it was required that you take this class. And, of course, it was the first writing assignment for the coming back, and it was basically the same old thing of, what did you do on your summer vacation? And I thought, okay, I don't want to relive telling about bucking hay, feeding the cows, milking the cows, mowing your grass, everything, all that was done that way. And I didn't do the assignment. And she called me up, and she says, why didn't you do this? And I told her, I don't want to do that. And she told me, okay, I'll tell you what you do. You go home, and you write me a story of whatever you want to write. I don't care. So I returned back to it, that kind of taking a takeoff on the old the Christine thing of Stephen King's thing. Was that wrote this story about a Camaro that was in a salvage yard that had just a slight bend in its fenders, and this kid who was kind of the nerdy kid at school, he saved up and he bought this car for just a few $100, and he worked on it, fixed it up, and now the car became the star of the town. It was the best car. It was the fastest car. He won all these drag races, and he was starting to become the super cool dude that everybody liked. And he was racing this other kid from another nearby town, and the car loses control and rolls and kills him, and the car goes right back to the salvage yard. And she saw that. She says, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to give assignments to everyone, but you don't have to follow them. She said, I just want you to write me whatever you want to write about. And that's how I got through that class.
What a wonderful teacher.
Yes.
I'm envious. If I'd have had a teacher like that, I would have probably not almost given up many years ago, because she encouraged you. She saw something in you that was born in you. That, what a testament to her as a teacher.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like I said, most people, they didn't like her because she was older, and she was kind of cranky at some times, but she's always just... was always friendly to me for some reason, so that way, so.
Because you had a love, you had the same passion she did.
Yes.
And she saw that in you, and she wanted to help that, she wanted to water it and feed it and help it grow. Oh, bless her heart. And I mean that as a compliment, not as an insult, because there were not, back when you and I were in school, there were not that many teachers out there in high school or elementary school that encouraged their students to expand that craft. They were too busy being diametrically correct. You know, you have to do an outline. You have to do this. You have to do that. When all I wanted to do was write, just like you did. You just wrote, and she saw that in you. How amazing.
Oh, yeah, and that was done on that old typewriter that my sister got, so.
Oh, what a testament to her. Now, what I find interesting, knowing that, and knowing what I found out about you, you went to Crowder College after you got out of high school. What did you study in Crowder College, and why did you study it?
Automotive technologies first. Because one of my main loves was cars. I mean, I was the car guy in high school. If you want to know anything about a car, I was the person you came to talk to, and they would be that way. I would know all the makes and models and when they were starting to be built and everything about them. And I thought, okay, started out, actually, when I graduated high school, I went to a factory, a shoe factory, and I lasted about 1 week there because I was had the bad habit. I should have known now that my writer's brain was always on. I would have these, instead of doing what I was supposed to be doing, putting a little bow on a shoe, I would have these ideas of, okay, what happens if a bad guy came in here and this other guy was working with, like Secret Service guys and everything was this way, and it was always some kind of story was built into my head, and I just never realized it, I guess, back even then. And I lasted about a week, and then I was fired from there. And my best friend, he said, well, I'm going to Crowder, so you want to go too? And I thought, okay. We went for automotive technology, and that's where you learn to fix them and build them. And, yeah, I can rebuild a big block motor or something from the 1960s or 70s to now. I wouldn't have had a change of spark plugs probably on them. But we went to that, and that's when I started getting the idea, okay, I want to own a car dealership. So, you know, I'll have like a Chevy dealership or something like that. And after I got through with the automotive stuff, I went to business classes. And that's what I was planning on doing. But I had no idea even back then when I was going to be a writer. And that was when I met Leanne. She was in at Crowder too. And she was always wanting to be a writer. I mean, she's just like had it all figured out. And the best thing I wanted to do was probably a big time dream would be a rock and roll star, like, you know, like Freddie Mercury, a Queen or something like that. But God didn't bless me with that talent there. So,
well, how did you get involved in writing in automotive magazines and writing your book, Chevelle SS Restoration? What kick-started that? Was it the going to school and getting into automotive technology?
Not actually. No, when I got out, I got out of college, my mother developed severe rheumatoid arthritis to the point that she was either going to have to go to a nursing home or I could stay and take care of her, and I couldn't put her in a nursing home. I just couldn't do that. So I started just basically I had to be there almost all the time to take care of her. But there was other times that I was just down and I didn't just want to watch TV all day long. And I got the idea, okay, I want to do something. So I dug that old typewriter out and I started to write things. And, of course, I got rejections like everything because I started out with fiction. And as you know, that's one of the biggest things of rejections there are.
Absolutely.
So I went back to the old thing. The one thing is you write what you know about.
Mm-hmm.
All I know about cars. So I wrote this article to this one magazine. It was Cars and Parts magazine, and it was about how to spot a genuine 1969 Z28. And I didn't hear anything about it. I didn't hear a rejection or letter, and I just kind of let it go. And I got a magazine in the mail, and I'm always getting automotive magazines and stuff. So I started flipping through it. And I come upon this article that says, how to spot a genuine Z28. I thought, well, that's like mine. And all of a sudden, I saw my name up in the byline. They could have heard me yelling in New York City. I was dancing out in the yard nearly.
Did you get paid for it? That's the question.
Yeah, eventually I did. At first, I didn't. But I contacted them. And I got paid, I think it was like $25, but that was one of the best $25 I think I ever made in my life.
And then you went on to write books under another pen name. Were they automotive books?
Yes, that's automotive books. That's when I started my own company. Because I went to, well, the first book, that Chevelle book, was with Motorbooks. And I sent them an outline, and they called back and said, hey, we was thinking about doing something like this, and we want to send you a contract. And, okay. And then that's when they said, okay, we'll give you $5,000 here for an advance. And I'm going, okay, I've hit the big time here. And got that, and... that was back in the old days. I mean, it's not like now when we can, if digital stuff, we can put pictures in with all the book itself and lay the book out. This was done back before when they had to lay it out manually and then take pictures of it to put it into the printer. When I sent that in, I had to take all the photos of graphs of in the book too, so I kind of had to learn photography on that, and then illustrations from like Chevrolet, Chevy part manuals and stuff like this, and it weighed about 45 pounds when I sent it off, so through the mail.
But it was a wonderful feeling, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was, to get that book back. But it took over a year to get that done, and it's just amazing now how you can send the whole thing through the internet. The printer can send it back, and it's just like night and day now.
it's all done digitally. All right, under, and are those books still in print?
Most of them are, yeah. The Chevelle book is actually still in print, and it's still selling. I still get royalties on it.
So if someone has some classic cars, because down here in Florida we have a lot of classic cars. In fact, every year up in Cocoa Beach they have a classic car show, and I mean, some of those cars I don't even want to walk by because I don't even want to look at it because I'm afraid something will happen to it. If someone wanted or needed a restoration guide on, let's say, the Chevelle or any other car that you might have done a book on, what pen name would they have to look under?
Well, they wouldn't. That's all my name. It's Paul Hurd on those. Then I've got some with my own. I have, I got Carl Eden as one. That was my father-in-law's name. And he was always a Ford man, and he passed away. And I thought, well, I'll honor him by putting his name on the title. It was for a restoration for Torino and Mercury Cyclone.
And that brings me up to, first, the statement that you made, I didn't choose writing, it chose me. Why do you say that?
Well, again, like I said, I never, like Leanne was, and she was always wanting to be a writer. I guess I was. I just didn't know it. And I was basically, I had like planned out like I wanted a career in automotive. But I think God goes, no, I made you a writer, and you're going to be one. So.
And that brings me to a statement that I always try to make at the end of the show, but we're going to interject it here because it fits, and that is we all have a journey. And sometimes we think that journey is what we have planned out. Sometimes that journey takes a detour and puts us on the path we're supposed to be. Would you say that would be a perfect statement for I didn't choose writing, it chose me?
I'd say that'd be a perfect statement for it, yeah.
Because apparently from our conversation, you had your entire life all planned out. You knew where you were going, how you were going to get there, and what you were going to do to get there.
Yeah, that's basically it, yeah. I mean, I thought, okay, I'll be this, and to the point even I was talking to a person that had a dealership in town that thought, okay, how much would you actually want for this thing? And it just, no, and that didn't work out, so.
I'm going to say it was a blessing, even though it at the time didn't feel like a blessing, that your mom got sick. Because that changed the direction of your life. Because you chose to look after your mom, who raised and looked after you all those years, and there was enough love in your heart that you made the choice to look after her, so you had to change your direction.
Yeah, that's definitely it. I mean, that's because I don't think I'd have been the same thing. I don't even think I'd have met my wife that way even, because it would have probably been, because with that I had to kind of even put my social life on hold. And it was on down in my life that I met my wife this way, and she's the perfect partner with my writing too, because as she does, she helps me with like fashion or interior designs and stuff, which is beyond my man knowledge in it. So.
and the thing is, and again, I'm going to interject this here because sometimes when adversity strikes and things that we wonder, well, why did this happen to me? First of all, we have to say, well, why not me? Because we're no better than anybody else. But the second thing is, and I believe this with all my heart, and people may take issue with it, but that's okay too. The man upstairs that created this universe, he has a plan for us, and he knows out there in the future where we don't. And he knows that things happen that will put us on the path we're supposed to be. So sometimes an adversity, as in your case, is an absolute blessing because you could totally focus on writing even while you were taking care of your mother and you didn't have the added stress of worrying about what was happening to her in a nursing home.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, I always figured that, I always say that, you know, he's the ultimate author. Just as we are when we write a story, when we're putting the characters through everything, you know what's going to happen to them later on because you know how the story ends, basically. And I think that's how he is that he goes, okay, I got to put this here and this here so that I can get you to this person here who will get you to this person, and it just all works out that way.
And if you had made the other choice, you might not, A, have met your wife, and B, be the success that you are.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Now, let's talk about your pen name, because you said that the other pen name was in honor of your father-in-law, Thomas S. Mulvey. That name sounds rich, it sounds sophisticated, it sounds old. And I don't mean old as in age. I mean old as in wise and ancient in a good way, history-wise. Tell me about this name.
This name is my Thomas Mulvey was my great-grandpa. He was a full-blooded Irishman that came over here in the 1800s. And did you say... about rich, he was about as poor as he could be because all he came over with was a small little box he had, and I've got that box. And he basically had just a few things in it, and that was it. He was one of the first, I'd say, illegal immigrants, as put it that way. He was bonded out to a servant type thing in Canada. And he was supposed to be headed that way. And before the ship come to shore, he jumped off and came to America. So,
now, for people that don't understand when you said he was bonded out, ladies and gentlemen, what Paul is talking about is a lot of the Irish and Scots, when they came over to the New World, they literally... they call it indentured servitude, but they were literally slaves for an extended period of time. And being bonded out meant his passage was paid for by a person, and he had to work that passage off, which was 7 years or longer. Am I right, Paul?
That's correct, yeah.
And sometimes they were not allowed to be let go. Sometimes they were in servitude the entire time they were alive.
Yeah, and that's why it's so hard to find anything out on him. I've tried on, you know, on the Ancestry.com and stuff, and basically the name just disappears. I think the family's almost died off in Ireland. And
it's very possible that the name was bastardized once he got to America, so he could hide without fear of repercussions from the master that awaited him in Canada.
That's probably it, yeah, because there was the tale my dad told was that it was Mulvey was spelled every which way they could be, the, you know, the M-U-L-V-H and everything this way, it just all was, and he told me the original way the name is spelt is what's on his tombstone, and that's the way I spell it.
And it's an old Celtic name. So
oh, yeah.
If you could go back enough to find out what the original Celtic name meant, then you could find the old Celtic spelling, which is different than the Mulvey as spelled the way you have it, because I'm sure that it was spelled, I don't want to say shorter, but in a different manner than what you have it. And if you could find that, you could find him.
Yeah, yeah. And the S in the name is Samuel, and that comes from my wife's great-grandfather. So, because, like I said before, when I was doing Blood Necklace, she would do the interior designs and stuff like that, and so that kind of honors her grandfather too, and her as doing stuff like that with me. So,
and ladies and gentlemen, remember this name, because you're going to want to buy this book. Thomas S. Mulvey, Mulvaugh. This is an amazing name. This is an amazing author, and his books will keep you up at night. Now, I have a real quick question before we get into the good stuff. With all of your history and background in the publishing world, what made you go indie as opposed to going to one of the big six?
Well, I'd sent Blood Necklace off to a guy, a publisher I knew, and he liked it. But basically, he was just going to say, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to print the book up, and we'll take the big cut, and you're going to be doing all the work of promoting it and doing it out there. And I said, well, good grief. I own a publishing company. I got an extra ISBN number, so I can do the same thing because I have a printer that can put the book into paperback, and they do an excellent job. So I thought there's no reason to do that. So,
and that is true, and I'm glad you brought that up. That is why, ladies and gentlemen, that we as indie authors control our own destiny, because yes, most of us could get involved with the big six, but when we do, we lose. Not only do we lose control of our book, but we get 8 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
So after we've put, and we lose control of the cover, we lose control of the content, but we still have to promote it, market it, do all the legwork, and we get 8 cents per book. Not on the dollar, but 8 cents per book. Now, that's kind of not right, because we've done all the work.
Yeah,
you agree?
That's the whole thing. Oh, I agree. That's why it was. I had two people, and they basically were saying, okay, we'll do this, but you have to do all the work. And I thought, no, because anymore now you can do the social media, and you can be on Amazon and everything else. It's basically what they're going to do.
And you can make more money.
And you can make more money. And you don't have to have anything with, you can pick the cover and all the back thing, the blurb, you can do it and get it your way. And you're just not forced to take also corrections and changes that publishers love to make.
And you don't have much choice
to do that.
In the big six, and I say this because I've seen it happen too many times, they have editors and proofreaders who are people that, for whatever reason, want to write but don't, and they rewrite your entire book. So if they're going to rewrite your entire book, it's no longer your book, it's their book.
Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that is why we as indie authors do what we do. We control our destiny. We take care of each other, because this industry can be a cutthroat industry. I'm not going to lie to you. But we take care of each other. We support each other. We look after each other. And what we make is ours. We don't have to share it with the publisher, who shares it with his editors, who shares it with the copywriter, who shares it with the printer, who shares it with the cover artist, who shares it with the janitor, who shares it with the pizza boy.
Yeah.
The money we make is ours, and we don't have to share it. So support your indie artist. Believe me, we're out there, and back in 2007, I was one of the ones that helped break that glass ceiling. Remember when indie authors were considered a curse word? You know, the bane of the devil is upon you if you're an indie author.
Oh,
you're not good enough to be traditionally published. That's baloney. Now, let's tell the folks about Blood Necklace.
Yes.
How did it come about?
It came about with, I'd tried about everything because the reason I quit writing about car books is just after so long, and I was trying to build my company up, and I'd done 5 books in 1 year, and that just like to burn my brain cells out, and I was just pushed to the limit of where, okay, this is no longer fun. And so I decided, oh, I'm going to go back to fiction, and I tried a whole bunch of different type things. I even tried a fantasy book, and I sent it off to a guy, and he contacted me back. He says, I like your story, but he says, don't take this wrong, but he says, I don't know where the hell to put it. And he says, the two top-selling kind are romance novels and murder mysteries. Well, I have a friend that, of course, does the romance stuff and definitely didn't want to step on her toes or anything. So I said, I'll try murder mystery. And I was trying to think of one, and I happened to be I was almost asleep, I guess, or was in a dream or something, and I come up with this idea of a cop who finds his high school sweetheart murdered in his sports car at Roaring River State Park. And
still there? Paul, ladies and gentlemen, this is live radio. For some reason, I have lost Paul. Maybe he will come back. This happened the other night when we were talking to Leanne. And I had to bring her back on because we lost her completely. Let me see if I can get Paul back on here, as happens. In live radio, maybe he will know that we've lost him and see if he'll come back. Maybe he'll disconnect and come back. Paul, if you can hear me, call back in. Okay. Well, I will continue Paul's story until we get him back. What he was telling me was he had a dream, and this dream involved a detective whose girlfriend was murdered in his car. So he was trying to solve the murder. And Paul did an awful, awful lot of research on this book. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to tell you, it is a fantastic book. Let's see if that's him.
Yes.
Paul?
Hello?
Hello,
yeah.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah, AT&T decided to drop us. So.
All right, continue. I was fumbling through trying to get you back. I was trying not to have any dead air time. So let's start back with your dream.
Yes, I was having a dream about, like I said, that this cop from basically the thing was that his high school sweetheart would be found murdered in his sports car at Roaring River State Park, and I told a couple people that on Facebook, and oh man, people just started going, oh, that's a great idea, tell me more and more, and of course Carla loved it too. And And then,
How much research did you have to do on this book?
Oh gosh, I made the mistake of thinking, okay, this won't be any research like car books. That was a big mistake. I had to buy books on coroner and autopsies and medical examiners and police procedure and all this, and I was probably wondering what, if they're if the NSA is ever taking notes or something, going, okay, what the heck is this guy up to? So.
Well, remember earlier in the show when you said you write what you know? You know cars backwards and forwards, especially the classic cars. You could probably tear one down and rebuild it with your eyes closed and one arm behind your back. But forensics and murder and police procedures was outside of your wheelhouse. So in order, and ladies and gentlemen, if you want to write, this is what you have to do. Like Paul, if you don't know the subject matter about what you're writing, because I'm going to tell you, the reading, and you can attest to this, Paul, I'm sure, the reading audience is so intelligent now, and I don't mean that in a derogatory term, but they're so intelligent that when you write something like Paul did and you're not versed, you don't have to be an expert in it because that's why they have research, but if you just go out and write it and you're not versed in police procedures and what the ME does and how they do it in forensics, the book is not credible and you'll get called out on it. Am I right, Paul?
Oh, yes, because I got called out on one mistake I made in Blood Necklace, because when I was writing it the first time around, I had the gun that Rick Ryder held was a Smith & Wesson or a Colt-type gun. And I said, no, then I had people say, no, most cops would carry a Glock. So I changed it back to a Glock, and I had this one little scene where he's pulling the hammer back, and the Glock has no hammer, so it's
and they,
still
and they called
like
you
that.
Out on it, didn't they?
Yeah, I had a friend that called me out on it. Yeah.
Yeah, because Glocks are a semi-automatic weapon, and when you lock the bullet in the chamber, that's all you have to do. You don't
you
have
pull
to
the slide hammer back, and
right. And some Glocks, like I had a Glock, and I actually had a Smith & Wesson, and I could change my Smith & Wesson from a semi-automatic to an automatic.
Yeah.
So I could go to single shot, and then I could go to semi-automatic where it would spit out 16 rounds in a hair's breadth. You know, it was that quick. So, yeah, you are absolutely right. If you're not versed and you don't do your homework, they will cut. And that's why you need beta readers and editors and proofreaders for that very reason.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. So, but, I was focused more on the, you know, into the how-tos of what would a murder look like and this stuff and such as the, with if somebody's strangled and you do that and here's what shows up and all this. And it was just so funny that I had a Jehovah's Witnesses that come, you know, knocking on the door. And I happened to be reading my book and I went to answer the door and the book I happened to be was The Coroner's Guide to Homicide. They saw that book and ran and left.
That is too funny, my friend, too funny. Now, you've released the second in this series called Blood Curse, right?
Yes.
It is out now. It is available for people
Yes, it's out available now, yeah.
And it's the same detective.
Yes.
And let's see what he's doing. Now, this is the tell us a little bit about what's happening with Ryder in this second of the series.
Well, Ryder is, like I said, there's a backstory in it that why he quit was because this horrible serial killer he was trying to catch, and the very last murder victim was a small child, and that just messed him up, and he quit, and with his last dollar, he bought a Powerball ticket and became the biggest all-time winner of $1 billion. So he's now taking his money and he uses it to help people who can't afford a private detective. He only charges $1 a day to do this. And I have it to where he's trying to prove this guy innocent and he's finding it out that this murder that occurred was some similar like the killer he put away in Kansas City Butcher. And he's getting these roses and notes just like he did before. And these murders now are starting to occur in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. So,
yes, I'll be buying that book tonight when I get off the phone with you.
Okay.
and then I will be fussing all night long because I'm up reading this book and I can't go to sleep because I can't stop reading it. Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much.
Well, that's kind of what my friend Leanne, she said. She, I gave her a copy and she took it to school when, you know, she's a, and her doing her planning hour, she was reading the book and she forgot about the planning hour and it went away and she just got involved in the book. So.
Uh-huh. You see, you are my downfall. I don't sleep anyway, and now I've got to read your book, so I will definitely be up all night. Now, I want to spread the insomnia around, so I want you to tell the folks where you can be found.
Okay, I'm on Facebook as my own self and as Thomas S. Mulvey. If you type Thomas Mulvey in, you'll probably see me. If you see a guy all in black, that's me. And I'm also, the books are also on Amazon. And if you want an autographed copy, you can get it at my my author website, and that's T.S. Mulvey, and it's MULBAUGH.com.
Now, I ask all of my guests this because I think it's important, especially us as indie authors. We've got about 5 minutes left. If someone comes to you and says, Paul, I have a dream, but what do you tell them?
I say that you have a dream, you don't have a butt in there. It's, you have to go for it. Because the worst thing in the world, in my opinion, is to get old on your life and have that question, oh, what if? What if only I would have tried to write? I get that a lot with people coming up going, how can I be a writer? Well, you got to sit down and write. I mean, that's just the thing. If it's in you, it will come out. It's basically like me. I didn't even know it was there, but it was coming out. And even back when I was a kid with those little bitty stories and stuff like that. So I would say just definitely go for whatever you believe in.
And sometimes, like you and myself, we had a journey. We were on a journey. But the man upstairs detoured us.
Oh, yes, definitely.
In your instance, he put your mother's health path and said, make a choice. And God love you, you made the right choice.
Yeah.
And that set you on the serious path of a dream that chose you.
Yeah, that's what I think, so.
So, ladies and gentlemen, what we're saying, what Paul and I are saying, and we do this at the end of every show because this is so important. It's something that I believe in with all of my heart, is that there is no T in can. In other words, if you say, I can't, then you're already defeated. I have a brother who's mentally, right? Who was mentally and physically disabled, born in 1952, at a time when the disabled were put away and ignored. The word can't, A-N apostrophe T, is not in his vocabulary. This man has taught me more than I will ever teach him because he believes that anyone can do anything they want to do if they want to do it bad enough. A way will be made. As in Paul's case, he started with imaginary playmates that were on the farm. He made the animals human, and he wrote stories about them. that led him to go to a teacher who believed in him. That led him into college where he thought he was going to have an automotive dealership because he knew all about cars and wrote about them. That led him to a mother who was ill, who detoured him into the profession that chose him. Closing thoughts, Paul.
Just that you never know what's gonna lead you. I mean, you may have your life, you think you got your life figured out, but someone wiser and more intelligent may have a better idea.
And if we push against that, that we wind up the loser.
Yes, definitely. I think so. I would definitely, I think if I would have actually got my dealership, I think I'd have been a miserable human being. I mean, I don't think I'd like to even got up to go to work even.
And you wouldn't have met Carla.
No, I wouldn't have got Carla either. No.
So it was a win-win. God love your mother. I hope you told her you loved her every day in the world and how much you appreciated her, because bless her heart, if she hadn't have gotten sick, you would not be probably where you are today. And there is a bigger plan,
no,
ladies and gentlemen, and this is what Paul and I have been talking about. There's a bigger plan out there. So if you think you're defeated because adversity gets in your way, you're not. You just find another way.
No. Yes, you're not defeated in it. You just have to fight through it. I mean, there's times, yeah, I get down and depressed. That's normal, though. I mean, you just...
Well, we're writers. That's what we do.
Yeah.
We are an eclectic lot, believe you me. We have this self-confidence, but then that little voice of doubt will always kick us in just to keep us humble.
Oh, yes.
So we have to learn to just say, get thee behind me, boys. I've got this. Go
yeah, that's
away.
The truth of that.
So, ladies and gentlemen, go and get, thank you, Paul, so much. This has been a wonderful, 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 exciting show. I am so honored. Go and get Paul's book, Blood Necklace, under Thomas S. Mulvey. Follow that one up with Blood Curse, because I'm guaranteeing you this man has got something in the pike that's coming. I know him.
I've got an idea for it already. So
there you go. And if you're a car enthusiast, a classic car enthusiast, go look up his car restoration books under Paul Hurd. This man is a diamond. You want to grab hold of him. You're welcome. You want to grab hold of him and read everything he has, because I'm a very picky reader. It comes from my background, and it comes from my criminal justice degree. When I read crime stories or I read suspense stories, I critique them. Ladies and gentlemen, I could find absolutely nothing wrong that I would have changed in this book, except I want more.
Wow.
So,
that's a good thing there.
Give me more. I'm addicted to Thomas L. Mulvey. Thank you, my friend, for being on the show tonight. And ladies and gentlemen, he's coming back on March the 22nd at 8 o'clock. Aren't you, Paul?
Yes, I am.
And I can't wait. I'm so excited. It's been an honor. It's been a privilege. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on Wednesday night, and I forgot my guests, but I know they're important. All of my guests are. We'll be here at 8 o'clock. This is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason. And remember, very important, always live your dream. Am I right, Paul?
That is true. Definitely live.
And nobody can destroy your dream without your permission. So, ladies and gentlemen, until Wednesday night, good night. Paul, hang on for just a second.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, my friend. We have now gone into the archive part of the show, and people will be able to hear this part of the conversation, but we're off the air. I just want to say how much I appreciate you coming on the show, and that hour flew by.
Say what now?
I said I just wanted to let you know how much I appreciated you being on the show, and our hour flew by.
Okay, yeah, it did. It really did fly by. I was amazed by that.
See, and you were nervous for nothing. But now what will happen is the show will go into archives. When it goes into archives, Blog Talk Radio will upload it to iTunes. Blog Talk Radio will upload it to Stitcher, which Stitcher is played on Sirius Radio. It's that radio thing in your car that you pay for every year. You get all these stations.
Oh,
then
yeah.
I will upload it on SoundCloud, MixCloud, Spreaker, Podcast, and Podomatic. When I upload it on Spreaker, it will then upload to TuneIn Radio, and it will upload YouTube. So this show will be in several different podcasts, and when I upload the shows, I will put them on my page, and I will tag you in them. And my gift to you is to take this show, download it, use it on your author page, repost it, have people go listen to it, so that you will sell more books.
Oh, yes, I plan on that. I'll put it on my website, too. So.
Absolutely. Use it any way you want to, my friend, because I believe you're only as successful as I help you to be.
That's about it, yeah.
And I am only as I meant to say I'm only as successful as I help you to be. So I want you to do what?
No, that's all right.
I want you to take this show and I want you to use it. And then let everybody know you're gonna be back. You're gonna be back on March 22nd.
Okay. Yeah, I will probably like I said, I got an idea for the next one is where it's, I got an idea of where a killer is hunting police officers in, so.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh. Okay, that's a first. And see, now that's going to show up in the archives. The people on the live show, the only way they get to hear it is if they listen to the archives. Yay!
Yeah.
So that's a little tidbit for people that listen in the archive show, folks. You heard it first in archives. All right, my dear friend, I'm going to go and get off of here and get this show set up. And thank you once again. I appreciate you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we'll talk later.
Okay. You have a good evening.
All right. You too, honey.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.